Hello friends, how's it going? It's Matt Barr here and you are listening to episode 225 of the Looking Sideways podcast. If you can believe that, the show where I look at life through the lens of surfing, skateboarding, and in this case, very much snowboarding. One for the geeks, this. I'm just going to get this out front and center. So thanks for tuning into this episode. I hope you enjoy it. Now, if you're not a snowboarder, and I know our skateboarding brethren in particular are a bit like, oh, fucking snowboarding. It is a really interesting one, this, and I greatly enjoyed it. My guest is the great Eric Blem. I'm hoping that's how you say it, Eric. A journalist and author who's had a very, very interesting career in snowboarding and the media. In the years that I've been making Looking Sideways, I've been really fortunate to be able to pay homage to people who were influential when it came to my own career path. People such as Tim Leighton Boyce, for example. Eric's definitely in that camp. He was one of the original snowboard journalists, a few years older than me. A peer of a guy called Jeff Galbraith, who I also greatly admired back in the day. And Eric's work, in particular at Transworld Snowboarding, was one of the things that made me think it might be possible for me to hack some kind of career writing about snowboarding from the undergrowth. He was an inspiration, which is one reason that I really wanted to speak to him. But then he's written this amazing book called The Darkest White, which is about the life and death of Craig Kelly. And it's interesting because, as you're going to discover, Eric's a proper talent, and he eventually outgrew the snowboarding world to write a series of proper books that garnered him great acclaim. But he obviously had a bit of unfinished business with this one, and has returned to snowboarding to tell what I think's one of the most important stories in our culture. So I've read The Darkest White, and I've got no hesitation in saying it's the best book ever written about snowboarding. I'll fight anyone about that. I mean, firstly, what other competition is there? I personally can't think of any. For me, this is going to be a bit like, it's nothing like Barbarian Days, but it's kind of that good, and it's that much of a, you know, it lifts the bar if you're going to write about snowboarding history and culture to a pretty high level. So, as you might have gathered, I really enjoyed it. It's a brilliant piece of work. Like all the best nonfiction, it is about much more than its ostensible subject matter. And the structure, which we do talk about in this conversation, because I am an English lit grad and I am a fucking geek, as anyone who follows me on Instagram and sees me posting my reading list will know, the structure, it's really subtle and clever. And it's just really well done. I mean, sure, it's a lovingly, respectfully put together tribute to Craig, Eric's friend and mentor, who obviously had a huge impact on his life and who he clearly misses terribly. But it's also the grown-up history of snowboarding that we've been sorely missing. It sheds new light on the key phases of our culture's development. It's a biography of Craig, which is brilliant. It really helped me understand like why he's got this exalted status in snowboarding. And then it's a really dispassionate forensic look at what actually happened to Craig and how he died that sheds new light on the incident, and which for me put the entire thing I understood it more, and you know, it kind of wound me up, to be honest. It's really good and I really can't recommend it highly enough. So obviously I was pretty keen to get Eric on the show. Now, we've kind of known of each other for years. We've got a lot of mutual friends, but we never actually spoken until this conversation, which made this one an a special pleasure. You know, we covered the book, obviously, but we also talked a lot about Eric's incredible career through snowboarding. And if you remember The Chameleon, if you're of a certain age, then, you know, you're going to dig this one. Like I say, it's one for the geeks, one for the culture, as Clyde would say. So I'm going to let this one come in now. It unfolds like all those classic Looking Sideways chats in its own way. And I think you're going to be able to tell we enjoyed ourselves very much having this conversation. So here's me and Eric, The Darkest White. Enjoy. Sort of journalism thing. Right, I'm going to press record because the gold can often happen at this bit. So
let me just ask you just do audio, right? You don't do video, right?
Yeah, just audio. Yeah.
Good. My background is looking pretty ghetto.
No, just audio. I'm just going to
turn my levels down a little bit as well, because I'm quite loud, aren't I? How's that? Is that better?
That's better. Perfect.
Cool. So where are you? You're West Coast, right? But are you Encinitas? Is that right?
Yeah, Carlsbad. Yeah, when I saw that you were out this way, and I had remembered, I think it was Annie Fast who put us in touch together, possibly at one point. And it was like literally like a few months later that after she said that, and then I think you might have interviewed. Did you do Jason Ford maybe or Todd Richards? You were in the area, and I was like, too bad I didn't follow back.
Yeah, well, that was
a whole
that
coastal
was actually
tour.
Yeah, exactly. We went from, well, I flew to San Francisco, then went up to Tahoe, and then drove to LA, went to Ventura for a bit, and then drove down to San Diego. Yeah, I did. It was hectic. It was like 3 weeks. I think I did about 15 interviews in 3 weeks. It was pretty hectic.
Oh my God. That's crazy. Well, congratulations. I know it's a grind and to make this happen, and you just have got some great, I've listened to some great ones, and it's cool because I kind of places where everybody's stories kind of merge together, or you see where like, oh, this was happening and I was there and this and that. And it's just been really cool. I love it. You do a great job.
Ah, thanks, man. That's really kind. Yeah. So before we get into it though, so you sent me a little shot of Swami's last week. So have you, how was that swell?
Oh my God. it was a beat down for those of us who don't get in the water as much as we should. But it was just insane.
Yeah. I mean, was it
as big as swell of the
sort of what decade kind of vibes?
Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely, I would say at least swell of the decade for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it looked crazy. I was watching, Jimmy Kane on Instagram? Is he Jimmy Murphy? Like he was filming all the spots that I surfed when I was there, and I was just a bit like, fucking hell, like that. And a lot of good surfers getting drilled as well.
That's the whole thing. It's like, it's always big, but is it really working? Like even those guys that are amazing surfers, like down around La Jolla, and they couldn't even get more than a short section, and before they had to point it to its shore and deal with 20-foot tall whitewash. I always love it when these swells kind of clean everything up. It rearranges all the sandbars, and then the next swell is always just kind of like, it's kind of like waiting for Christmas.
Yeah,
you want to see what happened with the sandbars and whatever, and as it starts to mellow out, then that's like the time, and all the people that shouldn't have been in the water are beat up, and you can go and have a decent time.
I got pretty beat up when I surfed there, actually, because it always happens because I surf English waves, and where I surf is bad, really. Just because it doesn't get Atlantic swell, so it only really works when there's like a hurricane, but the rest of the time it's like wind swell. So every time I go to every time I go to Hossegor, every time I go to Australia, every time I go to the West Coast, I basically get drilled. I basically get reminded that I'm not very good at surfing. And I kind of had that experience when I went to you, like surf Cardiff Reef, got kind of caned. It was fun. But it was one of them where I was like, right, back
that's
in the pool.
That's where I grew up surfing in that whole area. And I always wanted to live. I lived in Cardiff forever. And then I finally kind of cashed out of that little coastal zone and moved just a little bit inland, bigger yards and actual sidewalks, more the family neighborhood.
Yeah.
And so I live in basically old La Costa is where I am now.
Okay.
And I love it. I love it. It's great. I mean, honestly, snowboarding, if I look at my life as a surfer / snowboarder, I've always been 51% snowboarder. Even though I live on the coast, I just love it, and it works for me better. So anyways, it was a big swell.
Yeah, no, it looks amazing.
Yeah, totally. So how do you I don't really want any of this stuff we're chatting about on there yet, but I heard that you read the book, first of all. You said you read the book, which is great. That's a big accomplishment because I know you're busy and you loved it. That sounds like pretty heavy, right?
Yeah. I mean, so I mean, this is it. I mean, I don't edit, like, so this is it happening. I mean, like, we're podcasting right now. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well,
yeah.
Good to know.
I mean, I'm definitely, yeah, I like to like leave it all in really. Cause I think it's a good, yeah, it's a good way. It's a good way of doing it. I love the book. I absolutely loved it.
Right.
Like I read it. I've just been in France for 2 weeks and I just read it when I was in France and it was, yeah, I mean, it's, I think I texted you, didn't I? Or I messaged you and said, like, you know, it's for me, it's like the grown up history of snowboarding as well that we've kind of needed, you know, like,
yeah.
So before we get into that, the title, I had a question about the title. Have you read Moby mm-hmm. Dick?
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Do you know the whiteness of the whale chapter? Do you remember that?
Yeah. I can't quote any lines, but I know.
Yeah, yeah, no, but like you remember it because when you read that book, it's like that chapter.
Yeah, you're
like,
chasing the white whale.
You're like, what the fuck? The title kind of reminded me of that chapter, really, as an image. So I wondered why you chose the title.
You know, I love that you brought that up because, believe it or not, my first published article that I ever published was in Powder Magazine.
Right.
And guess what it was called?
Same name.
The Darkest White.
Right.
And it was a story of it basically got my first published article and it was, and I can't take credit for it. Powder Magazine, Steve Casimiro and Rob Story took, accepted it. And it was some, friends, some people I know that were caught in this avalanche in Breckenridge after I had lived in Breckenridge and ridden this same run, this little, you know, side country, they call it now, run.
Yeah.
For ages. And I reference that in the book in one part as well. I say this run that I had done so many times and never even thought about it at that point in my life. It was all about, you know, when it snowed, the only thing I was concerned about was that somebody else got to it first, you know,
yeah.
And avalanche safety, whatever, was very much not even on the radar for me.
Yeah.
And then these guys did it and were almost killed. And it very, I mean, like, you know, it was a really heavy thing. And I sent this article into Powder Magazine and you'll appreciate this. I didn't really know anything about magazine lead time at that point. I was a journalism student at San Diego State and right. I heard about this avalanche and I wrote the Powder, which was one of my favorite magazines, despite being a snowboarder. I loved the article. It was all about adventure and small towns yeah. and it was Powder and ISM were my two like inspiring magazines that I read and were inspired by early on. And then I heard about this avalanche. I wrote them, said, are you interested in this story? And they were like, well, we're pretty much full for the year. And I'm like, full for the year. It was like, I don't know, November or something at that point. And I'm thinking, wait, the winter's just coming. How could you be full for the entire season?
Yeah.
And so I ended up just writing the story after interviewing my friends, literally on the phone. They were in Colorado and, I had a little digital recorder. No, it wasn't digital. What am I saying? I had a regular standard cassette.
The little dictaphones. Yeah.
Not even at that point though. I mean, at that point it was still a cassette, actually.
Right.
Cassette. This is 92,
and they had,
I think.
They had mics, didn't they, those ones as well? They had like little like plug-in microphones that you could use.
You got it. So I had a telephone, like a spiral cord, probably a rotary dial phone that I held the microphone to my mouth. And when I talked and then held it up to the ear back and forth through this whole conversation, when I interviewed my friends, I wrote the story and I sent it to Powder Magazine in a plastic. I went to a grocery store. I rolled up the transcript on paper, fit it in a little toy boat, like for the beach, a little plastic boat. And I sent it in a box to Powder and I wrote Rob's story. I said, I know that you said you're full for the year. This is a really special story. I'm a journalism student. I was a snowboard bum for a while. I hope I didn't miss the boat. Please give it a read. And then I checked in with him, like Rob's story, for like once a month for the rest of the winter. And toward the very last issue, he finally responded. I think that was a telephone call. He wrote back. It was early email, I think. I don't even know if it was email. I can't remember how I heard back from him. I think it might have been actually been a paper letter, and it said
it wouldn't have been email because
no, in 92, no, it wasn't email
at all. Because I I've got quite a similar story. So when I first started writing for White Lines, which was 96, and I've actually, and the way I got into it is really similar to you. Like I basically like just wrote stuff and sent it in and just harangued them and just, you know. Anyway, so I got a lucky break, really. Me and a friend of mine who had a bit more of a vision than me. Like he was basically like, you know, we should try and run that magazine, you know, like we can do. And I was a bit like, okay. So I ended up meeting with the French Alps, and this would be like 97, 98. And they were like, right, you can do the whole magazine. And we were like, okay. I was 21. So and we faxed everything. So we hand wrote everything and we faxed it back, and it got typed up by the secretary. And that was what went in the magazine. And I remember being mortified because she spelled teen as in the resort, T-W-E-N, through the whole magazine. So we got the magazine back. Obviously,
phonetically spelled teen.
Yeah. So like, fuck, you know, we're all like fucking stoats. Like, you know, I was, you know, it's like back then you're like so proud, like, you know, and I was just like, no.
Oh like, my God. That is
crazy. The pre-digital years, like it was it.
And so that was my first published article. I think I sold one to a local newspaper because I found out that Crested Butte would give free lift tickets or free lift tickets, I believe, if you could you know, cover your own lodging. And so I actually wrote my local newspaper and said, right, hey, there's this thing and can I do this? I ended up writing such a horrible story that the travel editor literally rewrote the entire thing. And it's my first published byline, but it's like none of the words are mine. And,
right.
and I got paid for it. I remember at the time, I think it was like $50 or something. And I was like, yes, it's in the travel section of the San Diego Union Tribune. But the first that actually was accepted was Rob Stories. And he just said, you know, hey, you've been done a great job not being overbearing, but we'd love the story. We're going to fit it in. And that is forever, because it was so dark and so terrifying to my friend who was caught and buried and thought he was going to die for several minutes, until my other friend by chance saw his toe sticking out.
Wow.
And was able to uncover him. And wow. And so it was such this, it made such an impact on me. That started my whole road to avalanche safety and learning about avalanches. And years later, you know, when Craig passed away, you know, we'll fill in all the gaps between here and then later in the conversation. But to me, the darkest white really was such a metaphor for what, you know, white is always this like pristine, like serenity, you know, thing. And darkness is like, again, evil. And yeah. Craig was all about the light. Craig was the light in our sport. And I always felt, and so many people told me, you know, when he passed away that I interviewed and, you know, I knew Craig, that it was like the darkest day in snowboarding history. And so it was just the natural title. I thought, you know, if I ever write this story about this, I'm going to call it. It's going to be my full circle journey, because I kind of departed from writing about snowboarding for many years, writing about other, you know, military and special operations forces and kind of a detour to this adventure journalism. And so for me, it was kind of a circular path back to the beginning of my whole writing career. And what better title than to title it exactly what either Rob Story or Steve Casimiro or somebody at Powder brought that out. I'm like, oh my God, what a genius title, The Darkest White. You know, that is the avalanche. It's so dark, but the white, you know, is just, you want to go and find fresh pow. That was what it was all about. And it just encapsulated so much that it had to be the title. And and I didn't know if the people would go for it. Some people wanted, you know, thought maybe it's too dark for Craig. You know, we wanted to be focused on, you know, celebrate his life. But in my mind, all the obituaries and tribute stories that I wrote about Craig after he passed away, it focused on that. And I don't think that, you know, serves Craig's story well to shy away from his death, because it was the avalanche was controversial. And he was such a learner, you know, a lifelong learner, and he would have wanted people to learn from it. And so anyways, I think of that, that's really where the title came from. However, so many people have brought up their own theories, and the white whale is really, you know, something I thought of knowing the literature a bit, just because you're chasing this powder, this thing that
yeah, you're always going after. And in that chapter, not to harp on about it, but that incongruity that incongruity that you mentioned between like the purity of whiteness and the purity of snow, but the darkness that it can, that's kind of like a theme of that chapter, which is why I love the synchronicity of that as well, the fact that you've linked it to your early career. And I guess it begs the question then, so you, as you mentioned, you've kind of, you know, later on we'll go a bit more into your career, I think, like as a journalist. Obviously I've got a question about the chameleon as well, which I've got to ask you. One for the awesome. Proper fucking 90s geeks.
Love that you said that. And by the way, you said it properly, because some people came up to me one day and he said, "Oh, are you the Shyamalan?" And I'm like, "Shyamalan?"
Well, that's fucking funny. Yeah. No, I remember those articles. I remember that, you know, because you're a generation, I think. So I was like super inspired by you, Jeff Galbraith. Like Jeff Galbraith was a really big influence on me actually when I was a kid, because basically when I started thinking I could have a career as a journalist, you know, and as a snowboard journalist, which is like,
right.
And I was probably like you, like took it quite seriously, you know, wanted to write good stuff, wanted it to be journalism, you know. So I was super inspired by what you guys were doing and what Jeff was doing. And like, I was also like really inspired by a lot of music journalism as well. But I really like the fact that you've kind of put that little nod to that part of your career. But we'll come back to that. So the question that I had about the book, the first question though, is, so as you said, you've been away from snowboarding for a while. You're a really successful author. You know, they had these books about the military, like you say, special forces, that have been hugely successful and critically acclaimed. So why was this the right time to revisit the story? Did you need that distance, do you think, to sort of pay it the necessary respect, almost, like to tell Craig's story now?
I think, first of all, Craig kind of gave the nod on our trip. I went on a trip with him to Iran, and he had chatted with me. That was at the point, it was about 2000. It was February 2000. And he was talking about writing his own stories. And at that point, I was just starting to go in that direction, like thinking, okay, I'm going to go for the book route. And I really had done my research and talked about, you know, agents versus literature and everything. And one of the things Craig said was, it's all about timing. It's all about timing. And I can't remember if this might be in the notes at the end of the book. I hate to give spoilers. But basically Craig had talked about writing his own story, and we chatted about it over the evening. And at that point he was really big into kind of analyzing his own dreams and stuff. And he said, you know, I'll dream about it. And he was so analytical and so cerebral. He was asking about, like, what do you think about first person if you're writing a book versus like third person, present tense versus past tense. He's all, whenever I read present tense, it's awesome. It's in the moment, but it just seems kind of almost trite, or, you know, because obviously the whole thing isn't happening right now while I'm reading it, you know, and for the person either, you know. And so he said, I kind of like first person, you know, written from the perspective of the writer, but in past tense. And he got that deep into it. And I was like, oh, you want to write a memoir or whatever? He said, well, I have a lot of these stories, but I don't know if the timing is right. I'm going to dream about it. And I said, of course, hell, I'd love to help. Are you kidding me? Oh my gosh. You know, the Craig Kelly is thinking of writing a book. And that was exactly when Tony Hawk's book came out, Occupation Skateboarder. And so we were talked about that, and Craig was very much in line with what I said. He said, you know, skateboarding is an older sport. Tony's huge. And I'm like, well, Craig, you're just as huge as Tony as far as snowboarding at that point, you know, legendary and what he'd done with his career. But he was very humble, and he just said, yeah, but it's not time yet. And then he said the next morning, we're out going on, walking down the hotel, all geared up, ready to go to breakfast. John Buffery was there, and he said, you know, I do want to tell my story someday. And I'm paraphrasing right now. I had the notes that I think I actually have quoted in the book at the end from that trip. I was an obsessive note taker. But he said something along the lines of, but you know what? Nobody wants to read about you until you're dead. And then he did this And he did this nod, like this mannerism that Craig, the people who were with him know it. He kind of lifts his head a little bit and kind of gives you a little bit of a sideways glance. And he says, and he looks at you and he just said, and he said, fuck that. And that was it. And so it gives me chills right now. It almost, honestly, it kind of chokes me up. Retelling it, I have goosebumps remembering this moment, because I always thought after he did pass away, just a couple years later, I thought, fuck, you know, he didn't get that chance. And he would have done such a masterful job writing his own story. He does everything masterfully. And, but eventually what happened is I was at a chairlift in Utah in 2015. 2018, it was 15 years after his death, and I had a Craig Kelly as my co-pilot sticker on the nose of my board, and this kid in the lift line next to me, probably 20-something, pretty, you know, geared up, like, weathered gear, you know, chipped up board, somebody who you would think would know, said, just looked at me and just deadpanned. He said, who's Craig Kelly?
No.
And I was like, yeah, and that's exactly my response right there. No, are you kidding me? And I thought, geez, it's that right. time. Like, it's he's going, he's disappearing. And wow. I went home from that trip and dug into my storage, and I had a cardboard box that I had kept everything about Craig, and it was literally just a black magic marker scrawled Craig, and that was his box, and it had all the stories I wrote about him. It had the coroner's report from the avalanche. It had all the I had printed out chat room conversations about people. A whole box full of just stuff, including like my press pass from the, when we went to Iran and Farsi, you know, and the duct tape armband from his memorial service where I recorded stories. Like, a lot of the stories that are in that book are from recorded firsthand from people that's right. talked about Craig at his own memorial service. So anyways, that was when I knew it was time.
Yeah.
Like, Craig was starting to disappear. And I like, wanted to make sure that this current generation knows who he is. And I've kind of figured out people like in their, like out 40-ish is the thing where people in their 40s and up kind of know who Craig is. And anybody below 40 at this point, a lot of them don't. They just don't. Gosh, and it's a tragedy. That's my goal. My mission for 2024 is to make sure nobody who has ever touched a snowboard has not heard of Craig Kelly. And that's what I hope happens.
Well, I think you do such a beautiful job of capturing, like, you said a couple of things there where, you know, I didn't know Craig and I never met him, but I know a lot of people that knew him, and the reverence with which people speak about Craig Kelly, not just, and it's not about the snowboarding. I mean, the snowboarding is obviously one thing, but just like you said then, like the kind of like mastery that he obviously had, even when you were just telling that story then about his inquisitiveness about like writing styles and narrative techniques and stuff. And like, I know Terrier a little bit, and you know, the way that he speaks about him is like that basically everybody seemed to like hold him in such esteem because of this characteristic, it seems like, because of this way that he carried himself, that he held himself. One of my favorite bits in the book is that story about, well, one of the most telling anecdotes, I think. I can't remember who he's riding with, but, you know, they go to this contest in the 80s. It's shit. Like, the course is icy. I think it might be Ranquit, maybe. And you know, now, like,
it's Dave Alden and Dan Donnelly and him were talking shit about the course.
Yeah. And he just basically goes, like, fuck off. Like, and you can, and the way you communicate it, you can see he's visualizing, and he's like, and it's that. I can't even articulate what I'm trying to say, but I think you know what I mean, right? Like this ineffable, you know, character that he had to do things in this way, and to do things with this really considered, thoughtful, calculated, but accessible, you know, whether it's snowboarding, whether it's contract, you know, you really capture that so well. And because the snowboarding's a given, isn't it? Obviously, isn't, you know, when you know snowboarding, when you know the history of snowboarding, like, you know, you know the tale, you know why he's so influential. But I thought you captured his person so beautifully. Yeah. It made me understand, you know, it made me, because I discerned that. I'd seen the reverence that people, because I was in Big White maybe 5 years ago. I was thinking about it, so I can't remember his name, but I ended up having lunch with this local that knew Craig, and he started talking about Craig, And he started crying. Like, and he was like, you know, he's probably in his 50s, and he was like, he was trying to explain this thing to me. He was a bit like, it wasn't just a snowboard, and it was him. It was who he was. It was this, you know, this mystical
kind aura.
Yeah, there you go. That one word. So I really thought that came across so well. And I also really like the way that you structured it, because obviously it's roughly a three-part structure, isn't it? You know, it's like the kind of athlete, the kind of free rider, and then I think you call the final part legend. And it's obviously about like the incident, you know, it's quite episodic the way you do it. Like, how did you arrive at that structure? Did you have that idea from the beginning, or was that something that came as you wrote the book?
God, man, you are queuing in on all these little, like, they're little, like, what do you call it? Easter eggs from the story that are so intuitive. I just love that you read the book so closely. And so, honestly, the first chapter is roots, or not part. Part one is roots. And then the next part is, I think, champion. And the next part is free rider. And then it goes to avalanche. And so it's three parts, but the end is, you know, obviously the end is the aftermath and the memorial. But it was kind of a three-act play. And one of the things that Craig talked to me about, and this is something I was going to reveal in an article someday, but, you know, you get it here at some point. But I've only told a few people this. Buffery knows it. Savina knows. But when we were in Iran, after he had said, fuck that, no one wants to read it until you die. We're at breakfast and we're chatting around, and it's still on his mind. And so he just, like, out of the blue, first of all, the night before this vision I have of Craig, we shared a room together, and it's one of those classic rooms. We're in Iran, first of all, and it's two single beds that are like beds that could be on a train. They're like 2 feet wide that you just sit in, like you could fit perfectly in a mummy bag, a sleeping bag. And then there's a little gap between it. And in that little gap was his yoga spot. And I'm reading a book. And he's doing like the, whatever the move is where you're pointing your toes up, he's up on his, you know, back, and his toes are, his leg is like a totem pole to the ceiling. And he's stretching, and we're listening to Bob Marley on his, one of those little digital, one of the first digital music, whatever that we called it. It wasn't it was pre-iPod, whatever that thing was.
Like the Discman. Discman. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So that's sitting there with two little tiny speakers on the nightstand. Bob Marley, Three Little Birds is playing the song, and we're just kind of chatting while he's stretching between breathing and whatnot. And so the next morning, he says, you know, after he said, I don't fuck that with the book, I think if I did this book, I'd kind of structure it kind of like, I don't know what Bob was thinking. And that's how he referred to Bob Marley. I don't know what Bob was thinking, but with the whole song, like roots, rock, reggae. But for me, if I did the book, he's so like, this is the engineer in him. He said, I'd structure it like that. Like the roots of my story, like the, you know, my younger years and the roots of snowboarding, and rock will be like the rock and roll era, like when I was a competitor, and reggae is kind of my free riding era and where I came now and what I'm trying to do now with splitboarding was just starting. I mean, he was just starting to splitboard, and I wrote that on a napkin and just as a thing, like I just said, you know, someday you're going to come back and hopefully chat with me when you decide to write this so-called book, and I'm going to remind you about this. And so it didn't quite work for my structure because I had to kind of slam roots and rock into that part one. And I was going to do the book, Roots, Rock, Reggae, as the parts. But then it's like roots, rock, reggae, and then this horrible avalanche. It just didn't quite work out. And so my nod to Craig was naming that first chapter Roots, and the inspiration was from him.
Yeah, so it must be great for you then to like, I'm guessing that this process, being able to revisit these conversations, being able to like have this steer, you know, from him from the past, must have been bittersweet when you were doing this, you know, like a chance to sort of pay homage to his characters we've discussed, but also, you know, your knowledge of kind of his intentions and how it's really clear how seriously you took that in the book, like how, you know, like the responsibility that you clearly felt like to sort of do him justice. So these little, you know, you use the phrase Easter eggs, but these little kind of, you know, him pointing the way from 20 years ago must have been pretty gratifying, I'm guessing.
It was very gratifying and also really difficult because, first of all, a lot of my stories are, you know, with the military heroes, and I've done stories about, you know, the tragic friendly fire incident in Afghanistan. The last season is about a National Park Service backcountry ranger who went missing mysteriously, and, you know, all these people die. And I've always had these people's legacies that I have borne, you know, to write about. But this was the first one that was someone I had known personally. He was a hero. I knew people. And it was also my world. I mean, snowboarding was where I got my start in journalism. So I had all this weight. So yeah, it took 5 years, you know, partially a lot of stuff happened personally. I broke my back during that era. COVID happened. A lot of stuff went down, but a big part of it was I was a bit overwhelmed with that weight of just, oh my God, this is such a giant, giant weight for so many people.
Yeah.
And to me, it still pains me. I mean, I had to let the book go finally. The editor is like, this is awesome. You're good to go, because there's so many things that I wanted in there. And it's gratifying for me to hear you, how you feel like I painted that portrait of him that was needed, because they wanted approximately 90 to 100,000 words was what they were hoping for, like 80 to 100,000 words, like a really tight whatever book. But as the editor finally said, you know, this is a biography, it's a sports history, and it's a disaster narrative. Plus, we have snow science, you know, all these elements. He said that you can't do a tight, tight book with that much going on. And so they wanted 80 to 100,000 words originally. What I ultimately gave them was 180,000 words would have been the total if you really looked at what I wanted to put in there. And we honed it down to about 120,000 words. So those 60,000 words that are gone, like evaporated, are so many special stories that just kill me. That they didn't get in there. But I finally realized that I did enough. And this is kind of, I'm opening the door to Craig Kelly. Some stuff that went out are classic stories that everybody's heard, you can find on the line. And I kind of made it a point to, you know, you see the end of this avalanche and to understand why he put himself there with these people. I really wanted to drill down to for people to understand snow science wise, you know, what was going on in all those people's heads, and you know, really get that apart, and then to lead up to it. So I used some pretty obscure stories that a lot of people, I don't think, really knew about, like him going to Siberia with Scott Schmidt, you know, for Greg Stump. You know, a lot of people would think, whoa, you didn't do this. It's totally snowboarding related, but it all adds up to the story in the end. And I can't exactly remember where this started, this question, but the circuitous route is that
I'm all about that. I'm all about the circuitous. People listening know the score. But like,
That was really.
It is tight though. You know, you say like it. The thread.
Oh, it is really, at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. The thread is really. You know, the narrative thread, the course that you plot through these different elements is really compelling and clear. And just a quick one.
That was the point. Yeah, I was going to say go.
just a quick one on what you were saying about. One of the things I found most interesting was how you contextualize his actual relative inexperience when you look at what we know now. Because I think, because he was such a pioneer, wasn't he, when it comes to the backcountry for snowboarding? But obviously, I didn't know anything about like the battle that he had to sort of get taken seriously in that arena as a split boarder. And also like how, I mean, I'll come back to this actually, because his different persona in that arena, as compared to his persona in the snowboarding arena, is one of the most poignant bits of the book, I think. And I'd quite like to come back to that, because I'm sure you feel the same about that. But
for sure.
Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, I found the history of snowboarding part so fascinating, because, you know, it's out there, that stuff, like, but it's not been told well. Like, you know, when you search for like, oh, Sherman Poppin and like, you know, Dimitri and Winterstick and you know, not like, you know, those beats of the history of snowboarding, like that are out there, but they're just all on sort of shitty aggregator sites, and it's all. I just so relished reading like an actual well-told you know, all, like for the Burton Sims stuff, the Mystery Air stuff, the court case stuff, you know, these legendary things that like we've kind of known about for years that have not only created the myth of Craig, but have also like basically are the building blocks of the history of snowboarding.
And his fingerprint was there along the way. And that really, that was really something I really wanted to do, was somehow give the average reader a little taste of that history of snowboarding. But it makes it readable because, you know, no one's going to go and pick up a book on the general audience. It's not going to go and pick up a book about the history of snowboarding, and or they're not going to pick up a book about, oh, Craig Kelly, world champion legend. You know, you have this avalanche that's going to pull people in. And then you're going to learn about it by you. What you need is a thread. You need a story. And Craig was that thread, and his fingerprints. I tried to pick out moments, you know, where his fingerprints are there. Like, I don't go deep into the East Coast contest and stuff. I focus more towards the West Coast because that was where he was. And it led up to what his very first contest. And there's also mythical things that were, that are, you go back and, you know, Tom Sims would say, oh, I saw him at the bank slalom and gave him my first board. Well, that's not what happened. He was already on a Sims board.
Right.
He did it, and he invited him to go to another contest. So, I mean, I really was able to drill down and over-research, but I know it's all accurate, exactly how it came about, how the bank slalom came into being, you know, who came up with it, exactly how it came down, you know, all these little things, bits and pieces, and people. And then, you know, in some ways you kind of, because it is a story about Craig, you want to go on down this rabbit hole about, you know, Bob Barcy, for instance, or whatever. And I would find myself doing that. And then that would help me understand it. But then I'd have to pull back and go, wait, I just went way too far to the left field here. And I got to get back on first base, where Craig's just sitting there saying, dude, my story is over here. That was kind of what I will bring me back to reality and think, okay, I got to stick on Craig's. And that was what my goal was, to have Craig's thread through these pertinent parts. Not all. I mean, there's stuff that's missing. There's some stuff that I don't even put in there because everybody knows, and can find it. But I put in hopefully enough so the general reader will then be able to find some of that stuff. And the people who knew Craig are going to find out a lot of things that they did not know about Craig and the history of the sport and actual like stuff from the court transcripts, for instance, and quotes. Everything in there is accurate. You know, that's just the route I went, and I wanted to, you know, thread this history of the sport through. The thing is that, you know, I'm hoping that someone who knows nothing about snowboarding and knew nothing about Craig will go in because of this avalanche. And that was why I focused on that. It's kind of a backdoor little trick almost, you know, people aren't going to read about Craig Kelly. And then once they leave, they're going to learn about him. They're going to love him. And then they're going to be crushed. And that's exactly how we all felt.
Yeah. I mean, so when I was reading it and I got to like when it gets to the avalanche part, I was like, oh wow, this is 2/3 of the book, like, you know, or whatever it is, like basically the avalanche, that the backcountry story, the story of him becoming like trying to become a guide, and that chapter, and then the story of the avalanche is most of the book, really, isn't it? You know, like it's really, really contextualized.
The journey to become a guide forward is about half, and then the avalanche itself is about the last quarter or so. That is, and I wanted that because nobody knew what happened to Craig when he kind of dropped off the map for those last couple of years of his life. There was only one article that was written about him in Frequency, an article that Galbraith and his crew and Ari Markopoulos put together. And there was, I think, maybe a podcast here and there, a couple little things from Burton, but nobody knew. And I thought it was important to focus on that unknown area. And some people are going to love that, you know, the journey to become a mountain guide. Some people are going to love it. Some might think, oh, I kind of wanted to breeze through it. But it really depends on what baggage you bring into the story with you, what's going to keep you going.
Well, I think I thought it needed it because you got to set up the controversy, is it Bellinger? Is that how you say his name? Rudy Bellinger. Is that how you say it?
Begliner.
Begliner. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
because obviously he is a key character in this story. And like, mm-hmm. you know, I think so when Craig died, I was actually at the European Open, which you mention in the book. So I went to that riders meeting mm-hmm. when they announced it. And like, you know, it's 20 years ago now, obviously. So I'm not going to claim I remember much about that other than like the fact that everyone was just completely stunned into silence. And as you say in the book, you know, like basically like, right, contest is cancelled. Everyone's going to go ride powder tomorrow. And I knew that he died in an avalanche, obviously. But mm-hmm. it's quite striking to me, like how actually when I read the book, how little I actually did know about what happened. Like now, obviously people did know what happened, and it's been a controversy in backcountry circles clearly for 20 years since it happened, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think I always I think the thing that this poignancy that I'm talking about is like it's almost like the lack of agency that he's got in the whole scenario, if that makes sense, you know, like because in this arena, like he was inexperienced, he was at the beginning of that mission that he was on, mm-hmm. and he was having to earn his respect, the respect of these mm-hmm. pretty hard bitten people, you know, like who mm-hmm. are not, you know, like it's almost like because he's a snowboarder and he's on a split board, we're gonna make him prove even more that, like, you know, becoming a guide, as you really paint clearly, is fucking hard anyway. But because he had so much to prove, because he was the first person that was trying to do it as a split boarder, you know, mm-hmm. it's almost like they're like, well, you've really got to prove yourself. And the thing that I found almost most upsetting about it was like how like, I can't think of the word. Passive isn't the right word. Obviously, it's not the right word, but I'm sure you know what I'm getting at. Like, basically, it was very much out of his control. Like, I remember when I heard of it, my assumption mm-hmm. was that, you know, it was kind of your classic avalanche situation where basically they'd been unlucky, you know, like, but then when I was reading it, I was like, fuck no, like there was like, it's like in the teens, isn't it? The number of people that are buried, like it's a huge number of people, which again, at this remove is fucking rare. You know, you're like, wow, that never happens. You know, like it's normally two or three people. I mean, there was the one about 10 years ago, wasn't there? That the New York Times did that huge interactive piece on, I can't remember, but that was a large number of people, wasn't it?
Totally.
So it was just really, I just found it really upsetting. I just found it really like, obviously it's a tragedy. Obviously it's, you know, but I was just like, fuck, this is so avoidable. Like this whole.
Oh no. It was very much for me as well. I mean, at the time, that's what really cued me in and made me, writing these stories about Craig, thinking what happened, because, and I want to be really careful. I don't want to give, there's stuff I uncover in the book that has never been told about what happened. I'd love not to spoil that for people.
We won't go there.
I can talk around it for completely. And what I was going to say is that you're absolutely right. To have 13 people taken, in a fairly narrow width of terrain with two certified, highly trained backcountry guys leading what I never knew. It sounded almost like it was one group. I didn't know if it was two groups. I knew nothing. And none of that was really clear in all of the reporting. And so, and I followed it very closely. And so at one point, you know, you know, Rudy Begler, he was definitely one. It's not an unknown fact. He was very much vilified by many, many people. And no one, you know, the assistant guide, Ken Wiley, never spoke about it for years. And then even when he came out with his book, my question was like, okay, well, how in the heck did this still happen? Like, he even danced around a major point that I really wanted to dive down to, which I do in the book,
which we won't spoil because I think it is worth.
But it is. It should be upsetting. Yeah. The fact that you were like upset is very much. I did my job because in telling the story, because people who did any research into it would look at it and were upset, but they also didn't have all the facts, and I wanted to get all the facts because about those people involved, because so many people were. we're wrong about certain aspects. We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
I felt it was important to give it actually the first balanced account, because there were two very separate camps of belief of what happened. And I just felt that Craig and all those involved, and especially the survivors of who went through hell, you know, trying to rescue these people, and the family members of those who were killed, everyone really needed to learn what the truth behind the whole thing was. And, you know, it was time. And I spent hundreds of hours. Probably I interviewed more than 120 people for this book, and more than 330 hours of interview. And plus emails, plus texts, plus, you know, whatever. Plus I went there to the spot. I mean, all these things to really make sure I had a really feel comfortable in what I was writing about.
Reminded me a bit of Krakauer Bukrev, you know, like Into Thin Air, The Climb, you know, like these two egos, I'm going to use the word, basically having agendas, you know, clearly didn't like each mm-hmm. other, clearly very, the defining incident of their lives for both of them, obviously, you know, and mm-hmm. have spent 20 years trying to reconcile that fact of what happened and try to understand it themselves. And this is one of the most fascinating threads of the book for me. And one of the things I thought you did really brilliantly was uncovering that those two characters, Wiley and I can't pronounce it again, sorry.
Beglinger.
Rudy, let's say.
Like,
you know, that irony of them having to try and basically look inward and be humble and show self-awareness to try and understand what happened. And I don't think I'm giving too much away to say that I don't think they managed it, really, you know. And I feel like it's only your telling of this story that's enabled them, if I'm not being too presumptuous, to understand it themselves, really, you know, because it's such a, so that theme, because, you know, like you say, he's a villain to certain areas of our community. And, you know, Ken's written a book which is kind of score settling a little bit, you know, let's say. You must have been that, I imagine, like, framing that dynamic was a challenge, right? Like when you came to that, that must have been a really difficult part of writing this book, I'm guessing.
Oh, I knew that was going to be difficult, and I didn't really know where it was going to go, and I didn't expect the certain characters and survivors to come forward with things that I had no idea about. And when that happened, I was like whoa, and I had to make sure that those were accurate. And I had to frame it in a way where if I wasn't absolutely sure, I would then, you know, that was the part in the end where I inserted myself into the book. And I said, well, I see it this way and this way, but these are two opposing views. And so because of that, you know, this is what I think. Sorry, I just got a call for some reason. If that showed up on your.
It's all good. Recording. I interviewed Thomas Campbell earlier this year. He just had email pings going off the whole way.
It was really tough. And I mean, I always knew, you know, first of all, you know, Ken Wiley's book is a memoir, and memoirs by their very nature are what? They're one-sided, 100% one-sided. And he very much, you know, I mean, there's nobody that reads Wiley's book that doesn't walk around away realizing that he very much has the victim mentality in there. And no one walks away from hearing stories about Rudy not thinking that he is the villain. And I wanted to kind of reconcile that and really look into it and see, okay, so how much of what Ken Wiley wrote is spot on, and is, you know, and there is not a lot of context. And, you know, journalistically, I felt that it needed to be told in that way. It's what Craig, when I wrote everything in this book, especially about the avalanche, I thought, would Craig want this? Like the way he was analytical and cerebral and empathetic about situation when he was learning about avalanches, he'd read a report and he'd be saying, and people would say, what idiots, you know, why did they do this? As a, you know, I use one example which very much ties in closely with what happened with him. He would look at it with empathy because he knew how many times was I sitting there at the top of a run, and I'd maybe done this test or, you know, a pit or a rush block test or whatever it might be, and went anyway, because it just seemed okay. You know, I mean, he was very empathetic. Way. And I think that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to give people an idea of what was going on in Rudy Beglinger's mind, what was going on in Wiley's mind, what was going on in all of the different characters' minds. And by doing that, I think it's what was never given before. It allows people to go into those minds of the various people involved at all levels and know a little bit of what the decision-making process was, and if there was a breakdown in group management, if there was a breakdown in whatever, if there was ego. I just laid it all out there. And as you know, you can everybody, and I will say that from early readers, there are various things that have come back after reading it. And they're like, I won't say everybody said that, wow, now I understand how this happened, and maybe not necessarily why it happened, but I would, it was, he said, some people, one person, I think it was maybe Jason Ford, I think that it was kind of like a horror story or like a train wreck where you like, you see it coming, like, don't look in the closet. Like,
no, you know, it's awful. It's awful.
Because you see it all building up. And that's what I wanted to do, because at the end of the day, yeah, Craig's gone. All these guys, these people, seven people were killed. And, you know, one way to honor them is to let people understand what happened, because then people will think about it.
The other thing that you communicate really well is the groupthink, and I don't mean that in the kind of Orwellian, like, super disparaging sense. I just mean that dynamic that we all recognize when and in the backcountry as well. You know, you just described a scenario where you've known in your bones you shouldn't have gone, and you've gone anyway. We've all been in those situations where you defer to the most responsible person in the group. And there's almost liberation in like deferring to that person to let them make the decision on your behalf. And whenever you read a lot of, you know, mountaineering stories, for example, like, because obviously the history of mountaineering literature is just full of like this type of incident, isn't it, really? You know, where basically like highly trained people, highly experienced people with incredibly good judgment make bad decisions, basically, that leads to really bad things happening. And I thought that was also a really, really interesting part of it, because that's the tragedy that you can see unfolding. You know, there's a couple of bits where you just like, someone just fucking shout. Do you know what I mean? Like somebody just like, you know, get on the radio, like just bang your heads together, fucking speak to each other, you know. But there's this inexorable, well, they know what they're doing, so it must be fine. You know, like there's really that. And that's one of the things I just found. I totally know what Jason means. I found it maddening, to be honest. Like I was, because you know what's coming, and it's, yeah. I mean, what, well, one
that's,
question.
That's one, good.
One question I've got about that part of the book, I was talking to Annie over Instagram last night, because I said, I'm going to speak to Eric tomorrow. And she was obviously stoked. Because, like you say, she introed us a few years ago. And she basically, you know, we were talking about the book. And I said, I felt that in this section that we're talking about, Craig's voice was quite absent. And I guessed it was a deliberate editorial decision. Because his voice, so I don't know what you think about that. Because Annie was like, I didn't feel that at all. She was like, I felt he was present in that part. And I was like, I kind of didn't feel like he was. And I felt that my question is, was that a deliberate decision on your part?
Well, it's a deliberate, and it was deliberate only out of necessity, because one thing, I mean, as a journalist, one thing that I've always, when I talk to a college group or anybody on writing, I will always tell them one thing, you know, novels, you can fill in every little bit that you need in a novel, which everybody, a novel obviously is fiction and not true story, and they can do that. And some nonfiction writers will kind of connect the dots. I just don't do that. I try not to do that. If it didn't really happen, I can't do it. So I would always tell people in my classes, I'm like, for me as a journalist writing nonfiction, I would rather have a hole in my story than fill it with bullshit. Yeah. That is what I've told people for years. And how can I say exactly what happened? So what I'd use was devices that would allow me to put you in the mind of Craig by talking to people who knew him best. Like one, you know, I went to John Buffery, his mentor and, you know, closest friend in the backcountry for many years, and said, what do you think was going on through Craig's mind at this point? And then I also led up to that moment of going into this slope. I then reviewed back into all the schooling he'd been doing just recently and said, well, he learned this and he learned this, and he actually said this about this, you know, so you could infer what was going on in his mind from all the vast amount of research and that I was privy to, you know, his own notes and everything about what do you do in a situation like this. So I was able to say he would have been looking at this, he would have been probing the snow in this way, and he knew that this was this because of the class he just took 2 months earlier, whatever it is. I connected those dots in that way, because for me to do anything else would have just been it would have been me being presumptuous. And if I'm going to be presumptuous, I'll let it be done in a way that's journalistically accurate. So I think that what I did do is, you know, at that final tea break, I was able to say what Craig did, one thing he did right away, and I put it in there. He knew the elevation he was at. He knew the what it was snowing, and what he put in that little guidebook, you know, right to the end. And in that guidebook, by the way, was what? A picture of his daughter in a little bunny suit, you know, that I said that a chapter earlier, if that cued in when he did that. So things like that I was able to do. And then from there, I set up the whole scenario by talking to people who were there. That, you know, I talked to nearly every single person on the record who is still breathing, and or looked at interviews that, you know, were I was privy to that were taken just days after the event. All these things, I was able to add up those moments. And I think that you could look at it and kind of understand from Craig's history what was going on. So again, it was deliberate, but only out of necessity to be for my journalistic integrity and the integrity of the story.
That makes sense. You know, I was just thinking of Truman Capote when you were talking, and like something like In Cold Blood, where there's a lot of dot joining, isn't there? You know, there's a lot of like, and it's quite a thing with narrative nonfiction. I think Krakow does it as well, really. You know, there's a lot of, there is a kind of blurring of, you know, reality and evidence, isn't there, at points to sort of the story along, if you like, you know.
Well, some people say don't ever, you know, there's that classic line, don't ever let something like the truth get in the way of telling a good story. And what really I think led me to this in my career was I did a story on a, you know, a friendly fire incident that happened in Afghanistan in the special operations community. And during my research of that, I interviewed some guys who were with the Northern Alliance, the, you know, the so-called horse soldiers that were riding horseback with the Northern Alliance, you know, when they went into Afghanistan. And I spoke to a couple key characters that were in a very, very the definitive book, let's say, about that part of the war, a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. And I spoke to two people about a scene in that book. I was interviewing them, and this one guy said, you know, I just had to tell you that what the writer wrote right there, what I was saying to this person, was completely made up. That's not what happened. He said, it makes sense. It's like, it's conceivable that that's what we had, but our conversation that was recounted in this book with quotes was not what we said.
Right.
And it was added in to join this thing. And I went, holy shit. It was like, you know, oh, really? It's like finding out about Santa Claus or whatever. It's like this bubble was burst. Like, here's this a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist that I thought that I held on this high esteem and regard. And I find out that by two people, both confirmed that what he wrote was absolute utter bullshit. And that was when I made the and it's a great story and I love what was in there, but the guy said, yeah, it's really cool, but it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And wow. And so I'm not going to throw the person under the bus, but that's why in some ways I tried to avoid that. Instead I went, you know, I explained as much as I could. I thought basically by building up to everything Craig had done and people knew in the book, they could kind of pull from themselves. Like I said, this run that he was looking at wasn't gnarly by any sense, you know, and it was a beautiful run aesthetically, you know, but to ride down it would be nothing compared to what Craig's done, but to climb up it is something altogether different. Yeah. And, you know, and so I just tried to do what I could do accurately to put the reader in that moment, But again, always trying to be accurate as best I can. And if, you know, I'm not absolutely sure, certain about something, oftentimes I let the person read it and I say, hey, can you, if this isn't exactly what happened, what did happen? You know, this is, I don't know. And if they give me something, they do. If not, it gets deleted. And that has happened in this book. I will definitely do that and let a person take a look at it to see if they recall what happened during this, whatever moment I'm talking about. And in some cases, you know, I'll write something that I'm not sure about exactly and I'll infer it, but that's never going to go to the print until I've had somebody look at it that was there and say, does this look like about what, am I filling in any gaps here? Am I making a jump here in this? Or is this, can you tell me what was said? And, you know, I will tell you, like, yeah, there's a couple of places like Savina, I let read parts and that I wanted her to be able to see and let me know, hey, did this, you know, what it was. And in one case she said, yeah, that's not really what was there. And I deleted it, gone, you know?
Yeah.
So, out of privacy and everything, a lot of stuff in the background that no one will ever know to get to arrive at like one sentence, weeks of work for one sentence.
Well, I mean, that weight of research really comes through, you know, like it's like I say, it's that work is worn lightly, which is another kind of testament to the job you've done, really. So I guess my final question on the book, there is a story that's been told about this, among this kind of, you know, backcountry community, snowboarding community, and you tell a different story. We're not going to say what that is. How have you had any indication about how that's going to land with the community involved, like the backcountry community? Do you think it will be controversial or contentious, the version of events that you tell?
Yeah, I mean, well, I will say one person who, I think it's okay to just say it. You know, one of the people I interviewed was Ted Carasote, who wrote the story, The Thin White Line, for Outside Magazine, which I thought was at the time, the best journalistic look at what happened at that point. And so I was able to interview him and you know, kind of compare some of the things that Rudy said currently, this many years later, and other characters involved that he interviewed literally days after the avalanche. So I was able to really make sure that the passage of time didn't fog things any more than they already were during that chaos. And so within that, at one point, I said some of these aspects that I've learned, I told him about it. I said I wanted to make sure. So this was never told at that point. And he said, basically what he said is, what you're telling me changes everything. It changes everything from the perspective. And, you know, he wouldn't confirm or convey what he thought or whatever as far as his personal opinion. But that's what Ted Carasote said, who is a great ski journalist, backcountry journalist. And so, yeah, is there going to be some controversy? I believe there probably will be. Hopefully there'll be learning as well. But I will just stand behind what I wrote. I'm owning it, because I think that's exactly everything that I'm saying. I believe is exactly as it happened. And, you know, and it's kind of like sitting on a ticking time bomb, because even like Rudy Begleiner, Ken Wiley, nobody has read this yet. It's going to come out in a month, you know, we're doing this in advance right now, but it's coming out and I'm sitting here just not really sure how they're going to react. And also knowing at the same time that, you know, there is an opportunity for healing and, here, but again, there, you know, let's just put it this way. Begleiner was not the only ego in this situation. And there's a lot of preconceptions about everything that happened based upon previous events and, you know, just what has built up over the years. And no one's ever had a fair look at it. And so I think that, yeah, I mean, how could there not be controversy when something has been told and everybody knows there's this one story and there's a couple elements that are very key elements that no one's ever known about? Some people are going to look at it and, you know, yeah, how could there not be controversy? I didn't create it. I didn't even ask for it. I just did my research and this is what came up. And then I couldn't disprove, you know, any of it. And then as I really looked at things closely, it's kind of interesting. And I've thought about this, but you know, over the years, like when an avalanche happens, I think one thing that Rudy told me at one point, it's not in the book, but he said he would tell people nowadays, don't try and figure out what happened if there's an accident, because everyone else is going to tell you anyways. Because everybody has a conception. Don't worry about it. He said, don't think too hard about if something happens, because just there, everyone else is going to already have an answer for you.
Yeah, and that sounds like quite a Rudy line.
Totally. Very jaded, you know, in that regard. Because again, he had his reasoning. And again, I hopefully people get an understanding of what was going on in his mind, what was going on in Wiley's mind. But then at the same time, so over the year, people can look at and kind of dissect and scrutinize an avalanche. Well, it's the same with Ken Wiley's book. You can sit there and scrutinize it. And as you look back and you connect the dots of what he reported, certain things become clear as well. And so both of those things with those two characters, I mean, honestly, it could be a whole other story, just that I could go much deeper into it, but I made it a point to kind of try and keep myself out of it and just try and equalize everything by saying, and you tell me, I mean, do you think that at the end of the day, I did a good job keeping myself out of it?
I thought you really did. Yeah, it's really even handed. I would have an idea what your view is. But that's just reading between the lines a little bit.
And the epilogue too. I mean, the epilogue, I actually say this is what I think.
But I think this is why I kind of asked it in the way of like, you know, approaching that dynamic
question.
because it is one of the most fascinating parts of the story, and it's one of the most like enraging parts of the story, really, you know, because it just all feels very avoidable. But anyway,
at the end of the day, it really, in hindsight, I think that every avalanche, you look at it, any avalanche, I believe, and a guy told me this, cause I felt the same way. But he said in hindsight, you know, everybody can say that about any avalanche, because there's always one moment of something that could make it so avoidable. It could be one. In this case, there are these multiple things. And for me, going at it from so many different angles, you get to see, you know, from various people's aspects and their inner thoughts and what they wrote about themselves, what they told people, whatever it is, however I was able to convey what happened. It's definitely, again, I'm not nervous about it coming out, but I'm anxious, if there's a difference, you know what I mean? I'm anxious to find out what people, how it will hit people. And again, at the end of the day, I'm owning it, and every single sentence and line and bit in there, I will defend to the death, like a journalist should, if they call it nonfiction.
Yeah. Well, as you can probably tell, I thought it was great. I loved it. So I will be, if you're listening, get it bought. It's absolutely brilliant. You know, if you've got any interest in
what is it called? We haven't even told anybody. Oh, I guess we did. It's The Darkest White. Yeah, we did talk about that.
Yeah, and I'll link to it, and you know, and obviously do an intro where I sort of talk about it. So as I mentioned at the beginning, so just conscious of your time, so a couple more questions, if that's all right.
You're fine. I'm good for, you know, a bit more.
I was hugely influenced by 90s, like US snowboard mags. I mean, we actually copped your trip to Iran for White Lines. We did it about 5 years later, and purely from reading that article, you know, I was a bit like, "Wow, you can go ride in Iran? Fuck, I'm going to go and do that." But the Chameleon was a classic, right? So just for people that don't know this, so this was basically, you were in basically like incognito, trying to splitboard and ride down like places like Alta, wasn't it? Because at the time, you know, there was Alta's still a holdout, isn't it? But there's quite a few resorts back then, wasn't there, that still didn't take snowboarding. It's probably like four or five, wasn't there, maybe?
Oh, there's more than that. There was around nine, I think, total.
Yeah.
But,
so, was that your idea?
There were several.
Was that your idea to do that then, to basically take the split board in? And because that's what the, that was the premise, wasn't it? You were going to basically buy a lift ticket, yeah. And get on the lift as a skier and then ride down as a snowboarder. So and that was a bit of a series, wasn't it? So tell me how that came about, because that was a really, yeah, proper standout story.
Well, I mean, again, I became the editor of Transworld, you know, pretty quickly, because people would step down, you know, and in snowboarding, you know, that's happened, you know, Lee Crane moved on and then Jamie Meiselman moved on and I was kind of next in line, and I had the degree in journalism and, you know, with probably the one person on staff that could try and manage that crew. and you know, it was a dream job. You could pretty much create what you wanted to do. And you would do that for a few months every winter, and then you'd go back and work 90-hour work weeks for the rest of the freaking year trying to put these magazines together. And so one of the ideas that I had after I saw the first split board, which was the first one I saw, was a Nitro Tour. And I heard about it, asked them for one, or they sent it to the office. And I just thought immediately, a lot of the argument at one point was, in the early days, was snowboarders on the chairlifts. You know, right. You can't get on the chairlift. It's, you know, you shuffle through the lift line. And it's, you know, that's why they try to make that part of the issue of why snowboarding wasn't allowed, because they couldn't get on and off the lifts, and, or they, we couldn't get on and off the lifts. And, when this, I just kind of connected all the dots. I loved 007 and James Bond, and at one point I thought I was actually recruited in high school, like when I was leaving to maybe join the Secret Service at some one point. And so I had thought about being in the Secret Service at one point in my life. And I just thought, what a cool story to just, you know, the first initial story was, yeah, I'm just going to buy a lift ticket, ride up the most crowded lift at every resort that doesn't allow snowboarding, and as a split boarder. And then at the top, wherever I have to go, you know, I duck into the trees, wherever it is, turn it into a snowboard. And my job is going to be to ride down the middle of the most crowded runs, top to bottom at every mountain, until I either get kicked off. And the whole idea was to prove, hey, we can coexist. You know, we can actually ride down the mountain and not run into people. And we're not going to cuss and flip people off as we go by. And, you know, whatever everybody would say, you know, why they didn't want snowboarders on the hill. And it was really just a kind of an FU to those at that point. Again, whether it was 9, whether it was 6, I can't remember exactly how many resorts, but at that point it was just a obvious snub your nose at snowboarding. There was no reason why, other than, you know, it was that elite skier mentality at the time. And I won't even say that's a general statement for skiers in general, but of those managements, the management of those resorts. And the classic example was when I went to do the second year. First year, I did Alta, Keystone, and Aspen Mountain, all in one like quick bolt. And then the next year, I did Park City, and I called it Irony in the Wasatch, because at that point, Park City had already bid for the Olympic snowboarding events that were going to be in the Olympics like a year or two later. And so they were bidding for the Olympic snowboarding events, yet they would not allow snowboarders on their mountain. And I thought it was such BS. And so that became my next resort. And then the one after that was Taos, New Mexico. And that was the third year. But they were all this theme of 007. The first one was called Live and Let Ride. And then each section had its own name. And I called it, I think it was Alta Pussy instead of Octopussy. Aspen was, I can't remember, but I had a little silly, you know, thing, the man with the golden glove and things like that played throughout. And the idea was I remained incognito because I didn't want to get busted as the editor of the snowboarding magazine. And I said that we had put an ad in Soldier of Fortune magazine looking for a snowboarding spy. And so I didn't actually out myself until years after, a few years ago. I think Jamie Brissick, a surf writer that you probably heard of.
I know Jamie. Yeah. Yeah,
he came and asked me about the Chameleon a few years after I had stopped working at Transworld, and at some point he put it in his book. I forgot the name of it. Actually, it's called Jamie Brissick, Have Board, Will Travel. It's on my shelf, and so we did a little thing on the Chameleon there, and then I think not too long ago in Backcountry Magazine, actually, they did a thing that I kind of outed myself as well and said it's time. I don't care. And it was fun. It's a highlight of my career. So many people remember that. And it was great. In fact, I still think that maybe I'll go and do one of the other ones and maybe put it together in a book. Because again, in a magazine article, you never have enough room. And it was such a, you know, it was such a fun story to write and to get busted. I mean, I did. I got busted by the ski patrol. Sometimes they would let me ride down. One time this guy, they actually, I can't remember, I think it was Keystone, actually made me, they called a ski patrol and had me ride down on a snowmobile because they couldn't risk me being on the slope as my snowboard to ride to the bottom. And then when I got to the bottom, I also asked for refunds every time. I said, hey, if I want a refund for my lift ticket if you're not going to let me ride. And they would say, well, it clearly says no snowboarding allowed. Even one of them had a sign right at the lift ticket window. And I'm like, come on, dude. Give me my – at that point, that's a lot of money. Are you kidding me? The lift ticket's like $39.
I mean, I went to probably 2005. I was staying in Snowbird and I was with a friend and we had the day off. We went to Alta to get a coffee. Mainly, you know, quite curious, really. And went and got a coffee at the base. And I said to the barista guy, I was like, so come on, what's the deal here? Why can't snowboarders ride this mountain? And he was like, well, snowboarders just can't cope with this mountain. You know, like the terrain is just, it's just so unique. And I was like, well, if it's got rocks and snow, I mean, and slopes, you know, like, yeah, it was just totally odd mentality. I mean, I remember that story because I think it, like, you know, that it was such a creative time in snowboard media, wasn't it? The '90s. It was like, as you've just conveyed, it was like you convey in the book with the story of the snowboard in itself. It was very much a time when people were just making stuff up, weren't they? You know, it was just a bit like, all right, well, this is a new thing, you know? And I think that's one of the things that really appealed to me when I got into it, because it was just a bit like, right, like you say, we've got six magazines to kind of fill here. You know, what are we gonna do? And no one, there was no one telling you what to do, really. It was very much like, you know, I think because there was, times were good, ads were coming in, revenue was happening. So, you know, you had a lot of freedom, didn't you? So
my first issue was the biggest issue ever in trans world history when I got thrown into the mix, and it was the issue was 504 pages, the buyer's guide, that my first year, which was like a phone book size. And you're right. I mean, at that point, it's kind of like if you look at, you know, surf magazines as an example, and, you know, Kevin Kinnear was a surfing editor for a magazine, and he really nailed it when he said, yeah, we're just going to do a surfing magazine. And what did you do in the original surfing magazine? If you look back in history, they slowly knocked off the different areas to go surfing. Like, oh, this is going to be our article about either, you'd have an interview about one of the best snowboarders. You'd try and hit someplace that no one had ever, you know, seen an article about. And then you start putting together themes. And like, I remember, I think we did one called the Five Fingers of Fun issue. And we did basically lift service, hiking, snowmobile access, heli, and catboarding. And so they're the feature one for each that we did. And I thought, wow, that's so cool. And, you know, it's all just a different way to give the readers what they want. And one thing that I did want to keep going on in our issues was just keep that sense of adventure in it, because it was like the Jib Bonk, you know, era, you know, the new school was coming in. It was all about parks and freestyle. And I was, you know, kind of right there with, you know, Kindred Spirit with Craig, where free riding was still to me where it was all at. And also just the idea of going and traveling and seeing the world on someone else's dime, in my case, or just for the readers, is that you got to have a sense of adventure. So I always tried to work in some sort of adventure story in every issue. You know, something about a personality. And then, you know, of course you trying to show the progression of the sport. So there was always at that point, the freestyle, the jibbing, the parks. It was very much a fun time where you could do at that point, you know, people hadn't gone certain places. Like, we'd immediately like, oh, you're going to ride in Turkey. Oh yeah, we'll do an article on that, because no one had ever been to Turkey. You know, eventually it's harder now, I think, because, you know, sometimes people say, well, everything's been done. He said, yeah, everything's been done, but the new generation hasn't heard about it. And you can always do a bit better. You can always build a better mousetrap.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, huge influence on me. And you know, and a generation of snowboarders. So yeah. Yeah, it's been great to finally meet you, man. Great to
absolutely.
Next time I'm over, we'll have to sit down and catch up in person. But yeah, I mean, like I say, congrats on the book. I really loved it. I thought it was brilliant. So yeah, looking forward to see how it goes.
Well, thanks for being so insightful. I mean, it was a pleasure to sit here and chat about stuff that I really didn't expect, because you just never know. You know, asking someone to read a whole book is a tall order. And so I appreciate you taking the time.
I mean, that book is basically, you know, I could not be more your target audience for that book. so that was not a chore in the slightest from my point of view.
I got a really nice, a couple of the early readers, you know, like Jeremy Jones has, I got him have an early copy, Jim Zellers, they've all, you know, just loved it. But one thing that, Brian Iguchi read it, and he actually wrote me just last night, and I don't think he'd mind if I say that at the end of it said, I think I'm going to be reading this at the beginning of every winter for the rest of my life, kind of thing. And that's what I was like, wow, that's kind of what I want, like that people will go back and do that. But he said you really brought it back. I shed tears of joy and pain, felt the love and loss. Your book left me feeling a renewed sense of inspiration and gratitude for the path and wisdom he gave to the world. That's what Brian Iguchi wrote me just last night. And I started crying just reading his text, because he's such a legend.
Yeah.
And so, people like that have read it. And yeah, we'll see how the world accepts it. Like I said, you'll get to watch the ride right alongside me when it hits February 27th.
So there you go. That was me and Eric, and I hope you enjoyed it. Now, if you hadn't gathered from the intro, you probably gathered from the conversation. I'm a huge fan of this book. I can't recommend it highly enough. I'll put the link to order the book in the introduction notes this episode, which you will be able to find at lookingsideways.substack.com. Eric has also kindly agreed to take part in an open thread about the book, his career, the history of snowboarding, and anything else you want to ask him. I'll probably put that live in about a week or so. So make sure you sign up to my newsletter / mailing list at the aforementioned lookingsideways.substack.com so you can participate in that when I put it live. And while you're there, you can leave me a comment. Let me know what you thought of this chat, or you can share it with your pals who you think might be interested, which is, of course, the best way of helping me spread the word about what I do. So to find out more about Eric and order a copy of The Darkest White, head to his website, www.ericblehm.com. Basically, if you listen to this podcast or you are a snowboarder, this book is very much for you. Okay, there's no housekeeping corner this week, mainly because I recorded this episode at the beginning of January, and I'm recording this intro at the beginning of February, and this is out at the beginning of March, so I can't predict the future, so I'm just going to leave it there. So big thanks, Eric, for taking part, and to you for listening. I'll see you next time. Nice one.